It's Central Time. I'm Keely Boltina in for Rob Ferret. You're with us on the Ideas Network. Coming up, many people enjoy a glass of wine once in a while, but it can be hard to navigate the varieties and the regions to find what works for your taste. For Food Friday, we've got a wine expert ready to help. That is ahead. First, we're talking about what growing up in small-town America is like for girls and women. And when we think about that, we want to think about how rural communities affect the health and life trajectories of girls as they grow older. And you are part of this conversation. So join us now to share your experiences. The number is 800-642-1234. We're wondering, how do you think growing up in a small town has influenced the trajectory of your life? What do you see that's changed from when you were growing up? Or maybe what remains the same a few years, a few generations later? 800-642-1234 is the number to call. Just a few years ago, life expectancy dropped among the least educated white Americans. It happened between 2014 and 2017, and it was especially significant for women who didn't graduate from high school. They were dying on average 5 years earlier than women the generation before them. When our guest saw this data, she thought of the place where she grew up and of her childhood best friend, whose life had turned out to be very different from her own. Monica Potts is a senior politics reporter for 538. She's also the author of The Forgotten Girls, a memoir of friendship and lost promise in rural America. Monica, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you so much for having me.
Monica, where did you grow up?
I grew up in Clinton, Arkansas. It's a small town of between 2,500 and 2,600 people on the southern edge of the Ozark Mountains in northern Arkansas. It's a really small community, really remote, and really religious. So it's a unique place in American life.
Is it so unique that you feel like your experiences there really only apply to people in that area? Or do you see this kind of experience really translating across the country?
Oh, I see it translating across the country. I think part of the reason I wanted to come back here and write about my experiences in this small town is that I see some of the challenges and some of the experiences happening here in Clinton, happening everywhere. There's, small towns are losing a lot of their younger people. Women in small towns are losing life expectancy. It's something that's hitting rural America across the country. So I wanted to sort of use my particular experiences to shed a light on what's happening all across rural America.
You don't have to get too far into your book, The Forgotten Girls, to read that you describe Clinton with the phrase overwhelmingly evangelical and Protestant. What effect did that have on you and in particular, other girls growing up in that community?
Mm-hmm. We were growing up in the 1980s and 1990s here. And during that time, there was a big push for abstinence-only sex education, for a movement called True Love Waits that pushed people to think about, or pushed young girls to think about their marriages down the road. And so we had a really traditional expectations for our upbringing. We thought of ourselves as future wives and mothers first. There was a really strict taboo against having sexual relationships with boyfriends before you got married. And that really kind of changed how we thought about our potential futures. We were supposed to be helpmates for our future husbands. We thought about our careers as secondary to becoming mothers. And I think that kind of traditional, conservative outlook on life affected the way we thought of what our futures could look like, for sure.
Did you see that beyond people who were particularly religious? Was it really community-based?
Yeah, it was really community-based. I myself didn't go to an evangelical church, but I still felt that those expectations were around, and it was the way that interacted with each other in school. It shaped the way that some of our teachers thought of our futures, and we saw that happening with my science teacher in one class told us that women could do the dishes better because they had an extra layer of fat on their skins, and that being a teacher was a great career for a woman because they could have the same time off as their children while they were in public schools. So there was this kind of expectation that we would sort of design our lives around being wives and mothers.
The expectation, right? Not the choice, that might be something that a woman might decide for herself is important to her, but that was what you were supposed to do.
That's what you were supposed to choose. It was really one option. And when you only have one option, it's not really a choice.
Monica Potts is an author and a reporter. She wrote a new book about how she sees politics and religion, education and poverty influencing girls growing up in rural America. There's time for your story. Are you a woman who grew up in a small town? Tell us what it was like. You can call in at 800-642-1234. That you can also email us at ideas@wpr.org. I do want to go next, Monica, to a woman named Darcy. This book is about your life, your childhood friend. Darcy's life is also front and center here. Tell us a bit about Darcy and your friendship with her.
Darcy and I met in first grade when I moved back to Clinton, which is my hometown, from a smaller town elsewhere in the county. We met right away. She was really a friendly, outgoing girl, and she wanted to be friends with everybody. And I just kind of immediately became friends with her. Even when we didn't share the same class in school, she would come over to my house on weekends. And I grew up with two younger sisters, and we would make potions in the backyard and in our bathroom and make messes, and we would go on expeditions. We had a big atlas that we would look at and dream about going to a bigger town somewhere, like a town that looked like we saw what we saw on TV, with sidewalks and neighborhoods and places to play. When we were teenagers, we thought of going to concerts, and we really just shared this dream of moving out of Clinton, of going to some bigger place and having some big impact on the world. That was our dream. We stayed close through almost all of high school until we started to drift apart.
We'll get back to the differences and the similarities between your life and Darcy's in just a moment. But we are taking calls at 800-642-1234. And we have Kay in Madison who's ready to join us. Hi, Kay.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I have lived both sides of the question. When my parents first moved to Madison from Illinois when I was a toddler, we rented a house, which was a great experience, on a mink ranch going towards Oregon. I think it was on Highway 14. So I went to Oregon Public Schools until I was in the fourth grade when we moved into Madison on the west side. And the one thing I carried with me all of my life from my teachers in Oregon, where there was a lot of farm families, one teacher said, if you don't learn proper English and grammar, people are going to think you're a Yahoo. And I am quite frankly appalled today at the way that people have ruined the English language, especially prepositions like I'm excited for something, and him and me.
Yeah, Kay, thank you so much. And I want to keep the conversation focused on that experience. So I appreciate the fact that you brought that forward. And I also hear Kay speaking to the fact that there are additional expectations for women that you need to seem a certain way to be accepted. And I do think, Monica, that that relates to some of the experiences that you've had too.
Yeah, I think that's right. The expectation that you have to try harder and excel more. And even when you do that, that's just what's expected of you as a woman. You don't necessarily get extra credit or a pat on the back for that. It's just an expectation.
Other things, when you think about how women were viewed differently growing up in Clinton, or girls growing up in Clinton, what did it feel like to grow up in that small town?
You know, I think there were aspects of it when we were very young that were kind of magical. And I'm sure that that's true in a lot of places, but we had sort of the run of the place. We could run around the neighborhoods near the school that existed on our own, pretty much. We could take expeditions down the old riverbeds in the summer when they were dry. And we could do a lot of things in nature and in a beautiful setting that I think I didn't fully appreciate when I was younger. When I got a little older, though, and I was in the school with the same people who, you know, had known me my whole lives and maybe knew my whole family, it really could feel suffocating at times, because there was this kind of expectation that you were just following in your parents' footsteps, that their destiny would be your destiny. And that was kind of hard to break out of that. And it started to feel claustrophobic when I got older.
We're talking with Monica Potts about her new book, The Forgotten Girls. It tells her story and considers what it's like for girls to grow up in small towns. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Did you grow up in a rural town? What was that like for you, going from girl to woman? And how do you think life in small towns affects women and girls? You can call 800-642-1234. There's a line for you there, or you can email us at ideas@wpr.org. We'll continue talking with Monica and also learn more about how her friend Darcy's path wound up being very different than Monica's own, along with your story. The conversation continues here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Keely Boltina. We're talking with author Monica Potts about her book that focuses on girls and women in rural areas of the U.S. We want to hear from you at 800-642-1234 about your experiences growing up as a girl in a rural town or maybe living in one now. Monica, back to your childhood friend Darcy. You mentioned that you began drifting apart kind of in high school and moving on from there. You end up going to college at Bryn Mawr. What did Darcy do after high school?
Darcy experienced a setback before high school ended. She found out she wasn't going to graduate because she had missed too many days. And that was really hard for her to take in. She thought she was still doing well in school. She was still making good grades. And so she ended up going to a community college the following year with a GED, but she didn't really stick with it. She dropped out soon after. She moved back to Clinton. Her life after that had a number of tragic setbacks. She developed a substance use disorder. She had two children with someone that she never married. They had a relationship that both of them say wasn't the best relationship for them. And Darcy ended up later going to prison in her life. And that's really when I met back up with her as an adult, was after she was out of prison and she was working to turn her life around.
What did she tell you about her life? How did she describe it?
She described it as a series of hardships and setbacks, but she was always looking forward to getting past her addictions, getting past her setbacks, and getting her children back. She has two children, and at the time they were living with her mother, who is their legal guardian. And so she was always really trying to look ahead and look forward. But she thought that she had made her peace with living in Clinton, but I think that staying in Clinton, we both felt and she recognized, had been a hardship for her. It hadn't been what she wanted, and it hadn't been what she expected of her life. And I think it set her back too, to stay in town.
So what do you think made the differences between where you wound up and what Darcy wound up doing?
I think a big difference for me was that my mom, and I talk about this in the book, but she was very determined to see my sisters and I leave Clinton to go to college far away, to try to make our lives elsewhere. She had felt limited by the opportunities presented to her in Clinton, and so she didn't want us to feel those same limits, and she wanted us to feel that the world was available to us and we could do anything we wanted, anywhere we wanted. And I think that that ambition and that support and that push to go somewhere different, to go somewhere new, was really good for me. Going to Bryn Mawr College for me was really a fantastic option because they really provided the support and the opportunities that I needed to thrive. And I was very happy there. I think that made a huge difference than trying to stay somewhere closer that might not have had the resources to really support my needs at that time. I think Darcy didn't have that. Her mom thought she would go to college, but didn't expect her to. And so some of that drive was missing.
You talked about the expectations for just how women should be in these rural communities. How have you seen groups of people, entire towns, treat people, especially girls and women who want to leave for school or for other jobs or really for any reason?
Mm-hmm. You know, I had been hoping that my experience was not what girls were still experiencing here now, so many years later, but I spoke to two graduates from my high school from 2019, and they both had sort of related experiences that were very similar to what I had had 20 years before. They were kind of discouraged from looking at colleges or opportunities out of state or far away. They didn't see some kind of career paths like working in a trade available to them. They thought they were only open to boys. They expected to pick a career that would be compensated less well than what boys would have. And they also expected to first and foremost design their career about around being wives and mothers. And so I think that the expectations and the norms were very much the same even after 20 years.
Monica Potts is an author and reporter. She wrote a new book about girls growing up in rural areas. There's still time for your story. You can share it with us at 800-642-1234. We've actually got Marcus in Milwaukee who wants to join this conversation. Hi, Marcus. What are you wondering?
Hi. So I guess I grew up in the city in Milwaukee. So I guess my question for you is what similarities and differences did you notice how boys were treated as they were coming up as opposed to girls, or the same as girls? And how were women who moved into the community who had grown up somewhere else, how were they treated?
Thank you so much, Marcus. Monica, what do you think about Marcus's question?
It's a really interesting question. I can say that boys growing up were just given a lot more leeway to make mistakes and to kind of figure out who they were, and they didn't have to always strive for perfection or nothing. There's just this middle ground that they could trod that I think made it easier for them. I don't really know so much about women who moved into the community, but I can say that women who are considered different or oddballs in any kind of way are treated a little bit like outsiders in the community. So I have seen that.
Mm. Thank you so much, Marcus, for your call. We appreciate it. We're still taking calls at 800-642-1234. Monica, you and Darcy, your best friend, both came from working class families. Tell us about Clinton's economy and also how you see economic factors influencing girls as they grow up.
Mm-hmm. Clinton's economy has never really been super vibrant. It was very agrarian before the 60s and 70s. There were a few factories when I was growing up here. There was a chicken processing plant that supported workers, but also supported the people who raised chickens around the area. There was a manufacturing plant for electrical cords. Both of those businesses have left, and the biggest employer is the hospital, or the two biggest employers are the hospital in the school. So there's just not a super big economy. There aren't a lot of large employers. A lot of the people who would have, you know, previously been subsistence farmers or worked in the factories are working in the low-income service sector. So I think that really sort of limits the resources people have and limits the connections that they have to anywhere else in the country. It becomes harder to learn about a life that's different from your own and learn about other opportunities and be connected to them in a really realistic way. And I think that affects women more than men because blue collar women and women without educations earn substantially less than their male cohort. So
you moved back to Clinton for several years. What played into that decision?
By the time I was working on the book, I was already traveling back here a lot. And I realized that because I had spent so much time of my youth wanting to leave, I didn't fully appreciate the things that I loved about this place. Some of the culture, the natural beauty. I just wanted to come back and experience it in a way that I thought could give me closure and give it the fullest kind of respect that I could. And so I wanted to have a different relationship with my hometown than I had had growing up. And I've been back here for 5 years and it's been challenging and interesting. My mom is still here. I have family members still here and my family has deep roots in the community. So it just feels like home and a place nowhere else quite has.
Mm. Yeah, I wonder how that perspective on the town has changed since you moved back or maybe stayed the same in some ways.
I think ultimately it stayed the same. I think for some time it changed a bit. I was really hopeful when I moved back and I thought I could make a life here and that maybe things had changed a lot and the world had opened up in more ways than it had in the 90s for people who lived here. I think I was surprised by how much hadn't changed, how much of the prevailing attitudes hadn't changed and the prevailing culture and some of the ways that women were expected to live their lives were very much the same in a way that was surprising to me.
Mm-hmm. We talked about Darcy and addiction, which is a universal problem. How is Darcy now? What's she doing?
Darcy has, I'm very happy to say that Darcy has been clean since the end of 2019, kind of the end of the book. She's been stable and working, and she's doing really, really well. So it's been really good to see that change happen.
Incredible. Yeah, that's hard work. You know, you both came from the same place. The whole book is really based on this idea that your lives turned out so wildly differently. After writing it, do you feel like you understand why?
I spent really 5 long years trying to answer that hard, hard question. And I still feel like I don't have a firm answer, but I do feel like one of the things I tried to do was look at each little point in our lives that if they might've gone differently would have set us both on different trajectories. And so I think it's a million little things and a million little decisions and differences and happenings that you might not anticipate at the time could have these long running, long-term effects on your lives, but really do. It's really a whole life story.
We've got just 1 minute left, but I want to give you the opportunity. If a girl is listening to this growing up in a small town, what do you want her to know?
The world is bigger than your town, and it's bigger than than people might want it to be for you. The world can be as big as you want it to be.
Excellent. Monica, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you so much for having me.
You've been hearing Monica Potts, who's the author of the book, The Forgotten Girls, A Memoir of Friendship and Lost Promise in Rural America. Monica is also a politics reporter for 538, and she talked with us about that new book, about her own experiences, and how dramatically different her best friend's life wound up from hers and the factors that contributed to that. Coming up after the news here on Central Time, it is Friday, and that means it's Food Friday. We have a local wine expert with us as our guide to picking your next bottle or glass off a menu or at the store. We're going to learn a lot together, so stay with us. I'm Keeley Voltina in for Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. This is Central Time. I'm Keeley Boltina in for Rob Ferret. Coming up, we're talking with a law and politics expert about a new lawsuit that argues Wisconsin's legislative maps are unconstitutional and wants them redrawn. Now, though, it's Food Friday. Thanks for being with us. A bottle of wine can seem like a great gift. It's classy and thoughtful. But trying to pick one out of the store can be daunting. It feels like there's this endless variety of reds and whites from all over the world, and it can be hard to tell what the differences are and which ones anybody might like. The same is true for navigating an extensive wine list at a nice restaurant or an upscale bar, you know, or a not so upscale bar. It's just not easy to be an informed consumer on this front. Reed Joseph, though, is here to help. He's the beverage director at the Tasting Room of Monona and an expert on wine, beer, and spirits. Reed, welcome to Central Time.
Thanks for having me on.
Most wine drinkers have like some basic sense of a category they like. That might be dry reds or semi-sweet whites, or maybe just like, I'll take a red or white. I mean, where do we start to try to separate the differences, even at the most basic level?
I think that with wine, a lot of people overcomplicate it because the wine industry can overcomplicate it. The easiest way I like to try to demystify wine for people is that at the end of the day, when you're looking at all the different names of wines, most of those are just the different grapes they're made out of. And that's a little, it's a very basic detail that I think a lot of people somehow missed when, you know, they started drinking wine. But like if you go to the grocery store and you're in the apple section, and you're like, I don't like Red Delicious, but I do like Honeycrisp. That's the same mindset with, you know, getting wine. Cabernet Sauvignon, that's just one of the grapes. Merlot, that's just one of the grapes. And figuring out what wine you like, the first part is, hey, I know I like this grape. I know I like the way it tastes. I'm going to keep enjoying the thing I like. Like, there's a zillion details below that, but that's kind of the foundation I like to start with.
I'm going to take your metaphor and torture it a little bit.
Excellent.
You gave us Honeycrisp and Red Delicious, but is liking white or reds similar to that? Is it similar to Granny Smith apples and Red Delicious? Like, how do you know if you like whites? Are you going to like all whites?
Most wine is going to drop into either the black grape category or the white grape category. They make red wine out of black grapes. They make white wine out of white grapes. The color from red wine comes from sitting on the skins, though. So all grape juice is going to come out clear. With red wine, they take those black grapes, they let the wine sit on the skins. That develops the flavors in a different way. That being said, though, it's not like one is inherently better than the other. They just present differently. There's a saying I like to use at my bar, which is the only wrong way to drink is if somebody else tells you you have to drink. So if you're out there and you're like, hey, I like this wine with that food, and someone's like, that's not allowed, like, you can kindly tell that person to be quiet.
Excellent. I do love permission to tell someone to pipe down. Now is the time to join our conversation with Reed Joseph at 800-642-1234. On this Food Friday, we're talking about wine, and we want to know what questions you have. Do you find it hard to know what to order or what to buy at the store? Maybe you actually know a lot about wine, and you have a really specific question that you want to try to stump Reed with. He's game. 800-642-1234. Four is the number to call. Reed, some wines that are labeled as a single variety, like a Cabernet, they're actually partial blends and not purely the grape that they're labeled. So you just walked us through this kind of differentiation between the grapes, and now there are some of those additional layers. How does that work, and how can we tell what we're actually going to get?
The short version is it's really hard. In the United States, the laws about making wine are not as strict as they are in the European Union. So if you're buying a bottle and it says Cabernet Sauvignon, legally it has to be a minimum of 75% Cabernet Sauvignon. The rest can be any other grape they put in. Different, you know, wine regions are trying to lift that up a little bit, make it a little bit more stringent, but it makes being an informed consumer difficult. A great sign if you're trying to get high-quality wine is you want to know where it came from. So if you pick up a bottle of wine and it says Red Wine California, that's any number of grapes from anywhere across, you know, a massive state like California. On the other hand, if you pick up a bottle of wine and on the back it says 20% Cab, 80% Merlot from Napa Valley, you know a lot more specifically about that. Deciphering wine labels is one of the most frustrating things, you know, even still for myself, and you can imagine more so for the average consumer. But if you get to the point where you can at least look at a bottle and say, okay, I at least know that's a place, like a one specific place, like that's a great start. A lot of bottles will also tell you exactly what's going into it. And at the end of the day, there's nothing wrong with picking a bottle of wine and pulling your phone out and Googling it and saying, hey, if this little thing I found online says it's made of this, and, you know, that takes an extra minute in the aisle that I'm usually happy to spend.
Where do you recommend people start if they really just don't know?
The best way to start is to find a bar with a fun wine list and make friends with the bartender. Make yourself a regular at a bar with a fun wine list. And proper nerds will not shut up about the thing they're nerdy about. And so if you go to, I mean, like, I can think of a couple of really fun wine bars around town, or like bars with good bartender culture. You know, shameless plug for the tasting room, of course, but if you go to a bar with a fun wine list and you get to talking to the bartender and, you know, you try different things, that's a great way to have an actual person explain, hey, you should try this because I like it and this is why I like it, rather than what somebody on liquor.com wrote, you know, 10 years ago.
Yeah. And I imagine while you're in the Madison area, there are bartenders like that and places like that all over the state of Wisconsin and certainly beyond that would be willing to listen when someone says, I actually don't know very much about this. Can you give me some advice? Yeah. Fair to ask, or should we be afraid to be judged?
No, and this, I think that a great sign of a bad bartender is one that doesn't really want to engage with you and have a conversation. I think a bartender that doesn't want to demystify all of the things going on behind the bar, like, I don't know, that to me just reeks of insecurity. And so a good bartender is going to be like, yeah, absolutely, let me help you out with this, because it's fun. It's really enjoyable and fulfilling walking somebody through and showing them something new and watching them enjoy it and come back for more.
And what if I'm that's good advice for if I'm drinking a glass or want to try a couple when I'm out and about. But what if I'm walking into the wine aisle and I don't know where to start? Depending on where I'm shopping, there might not be somebody who is super informed who might be able to help me at the level that bartender might be able to.
My go-to for people is start with Italy and France. They're both ridiculously massive wine industries, and it's really complicated, but there are some buzzwords in wine and some styles that have been very popular to the point where now the price becomes inflated because people think it's supposed to be popular. It's supposed to be expensive. On the other hand, there's small, tiny regions in places like, you know, Italy and France that make these wines that you can buy a bottle for $10 and it's going to outperform a $40 bottle of California red. And I'm a lot happier if I buy a $10 bottle of wine and it doesn't turn out great. That hurts a lot less than if I buy a $40 or $50 bottle and it doesn't turn out great. So I generally say start, like, go to the France and Italy aisle and look at the incredible array of all of the things, and don't be intimidated by how many things there are, and just pick up a bottle in the $10 to $15 range. And if you like it, look at the label and say, I'm going to try that again next time.
Are there certain characteristics that are common in wines produced in those different countries? You know, you've tossed out, you know, France and Italy or even Spanish wines.
There are. And this is where you're going to get into. I'm going to try not to get too nerdy on this. You're going to get into the difference between the grapes that are used, the way the winemaker wants to make the wine, the traditional historical style of the wine from that region, and also the environment. There's this word in the wine world called terroir. And terroir is this very, very large word because it encompasses the climate, the geography, the, you know, the precipitation, you know, the altitude, the kind of the soul of the region where the wine is made. And if you've had a French Pinot Noir versus a California Pinot Noir, you're going to get a very different flavor. And that's terroir. So, yeah, there's going to be some things you'll notice about maybe northern French wine or southern French wine, and some things you notice about southern Italian wine. And piecing apart how much of that is traditionally wine from that region is made this way and how much of it is the climate encourages it, that's a moving target.
If I'm not overly familiar, will I notice those nuances when I try the wines?
Probably not.
That makes it safer, though,
yeah,
for me, you know?
And this, you know, this goes back to, I think a lot of people in the wine industry try to make the wine industry complicated. And I don't know why that is. If I was being cynical, I would say it's because, you know, the wine industry sometimes struggles. And if you make your job feel important, then you might make yourself feel a little bit more secure. But your average person is not going to tell the difference between a expensive wine or a cheap wine. I would say, like, once you go above $6, $7, then the wine is probably going to be pretty decent, especially for imported European wines. One of my favorite studies, this is done a long time ago, but self-described sommeliers or wine experts were, you know, given a red wine to try and a white wine to try and asked to describe the tasting notes. And they described the red as being dark fruit and rich and the white as being light and crisp. And it turns out it was the same white wine, just one had food coloring. So, you know, people can be fooled. You have to drink a lot of wine and really get down into the weeds in it before you're debating about, you know, left bank versus right bank Bordeaux. I might have just angered a bunch of wine nerds by saying that, but if you're looking for a good bottle of wine for a Friday night, that's generally you shouldn't be worried about the details.
That's good to know. We've got Tasting Room of Monona Beverage Director Reed Joseph here for Food Friday. He's helping us with some tips for beginners to make wine more approachable, from the driest reds to the sweetest whites, everything in between. We want to hear from you at 800-642-1234. How much do you know about the wine that you drink? How do you pick the bottle or the glass? Do you sometimes find wines hard to navigate? Or do you feel pretty confident and want to share some tips? You can give us a call at 800-642-1234, or you can post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Still time for your call as we continue talking about wine. You're listening to the Ideas Network. This is Central Time. I'm Keely Boltina. It's Food Friday, and we're on a journey to better understand wine and make that extensive wine list at a bar or a restaurant more approachable. Reed Joseph is our guest. He's the beverage director at the Tasting Room of Monona. And we're taking your calls at 800-642-1234. I want to welcome Bill in Burlington. Hi, Bill.
Hi. I don't have anything contrary at all to what your guest has offered, but maybe some additional. One is to shop your local liquor store that has a lot of wine bins, because typically there'll be an expert there, and you can talk about what you want to do with it, whether it's drinking standalone or you're going with a meal. And if you're introducing yourself to it, it's kind of nice to get together with some friends and maybe try some budget-wise, compare palettes, and find out where it's going from. The other dimension is I'm a hobbyist winemaker. I have about 160 vines, mostly Minnesota hybrids. And so there are wines being grown in Wisconsin and commercially sold that are great, that are worth trying. And if your wine bug goes deeper, you can often get kits to make wine to see if you like to do it. And that's another way to explore styles. At the home level.
Very interesting, Bill. Thank you so much for sharing. And a very fun thing that you do. That's pretty cool.
Yeah, no, he's absolutely right. And I'm going to give a shout out to two of my personal favorite liquor stores, Riley's Wines of the World on Gorham Street and then Star Liquor on Willie Street. You know, both of them have very fun, very interesting selections and, you know, staff who really like showing people what's going on. I also like to buy wine from Woodman's too because it's convenient. But if I'm hunting for something fun, I'm probably going to a place where I can have a conversation with somebody who is able to help me, again, further demystify it.
Yeah, that makes sense. And, you know, we do have this posted on the Ideas Network Facebook page. So those recommendations are out of the Madison area. But if you have a great place that you like to go, you're welcome to share that with us on the Ideas Network Facebook page. You can just leave a comment for us and we'll check it out. We have another caller. Scott from Green Bay wants to join us here. Hey, Scott.
Oh, hello. Yeah, I just want to say my wife and I really enjoyed sampling wines. And so we started with a wine club. But then we ended up creating a spreadsheet and tracking all of our wines on the spreadsheet and repeats and what we ate with it and such. But and any comment that we may have about the wine that we had. So I think our spreadsheet is well over 800 bottles long now. But one of the things we noticed is how we progressed from like a sweeter white wine up towards the drier reds, which is kind of our favorite now. So I was wondering if you had any comment about how people progress through wines, starting from where they start and where they end up.
Yeah, Scott, and I'm going to let Reed respond, but I want to let you know that he got quite a big smile. The corners of his eyes crinkled when you started to explain that you had a wine spreadsheet. So I want to make sure that you know that Reed appreciates your effort, Scott. Reed, what about this idea that we kind of sometimes get into sweeter wines and then develop and change our tastes over time?
First of all, I love spreadsheets, so thank you, Scott. You sound like a guy right after my own heart. I think that's not just true of wine. I think it's true of a lot of things. I think that a lot of people, like take coffee, for example. A lot of people, when they start drinking coffee, they start with lattes or mochas. And especially if they're drinking good coffee, eventually take out, you know, the added ingredients until they're sipping on straight black coffee or espresso. And with wine, I could say with cocktails or with any other, you know, thing you get into, getting into the approachable stuff is a great way to start. And then once you get used to that, you know, digging deeper and trying something outside your comfort zone. You know, I didn't think I liked red wine, you know, for years because I was just trying kind of the cheapest sweet red wines. And then I started trying wines that were maybe a little bit more developed, a little bit more character, and realized, oh, I actually really enjoy these. And then that rabbit hole just doesn't really stop. You wind up with 800 bottles in your spreadsheet.
Right. Well, I think Scott understands that very well. What about sparkling wines? We've talked about red wines and white wines. And sometimes I feel like sparkling wines have, you know, a bit of a reputation of their own.
Sparkling wines can be tricky because, you know, there's all these memes about the Champagne region of France. And a lot of people will then on the flip side, you know, kind of take a rhetorical hammer to American sparkling wines. And the thing with sparkling wine, I think that might make it a little bit less complicated is that every region is going to have kind of their own way of doing it. The French way, where you know, they take a little bit of the yeast and they bottle it, and then they reseal it, and then the wine continues to ferment inside the bottle, and that's where a lot of the bubbles come from. Like, that's a way of doing it. It's a very popular way of doing it. And if you pick up a bottle of sparkling wine and you see Method Traditionnel or Champagne Method, like, that's going to give you a clue that, hey, this wine is made in the style of Champagne, even if it's not from the Champagne region. But then there's other wines like Cava from Spain, where they add the yeast to allow it to ferment, but then they put it in these large racks and, you know, let it, you know, rotate it in big batches. And so a Cava and Champagne use different grapes. But for a lot of people, a great way to start getting into sparkling wine is through Cava, because you can find Cava sometimes at a less intimidating price point than you can find Champagne. The kind of, to me at least, the bottom rung is when you see things like force carbonated wines, where they basically take a very dry white wine and they add CO2 to it like you would a soda. And that's, you know, that's the stuff that's $5 a bottle. And, you know, that's the stuff that is not, it's going to be there for your Instagram reel, not for you to sip on.
Different purposes for different beverages. That's good to know. Yeah. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
There's sparkling wine is, it's a really fun rabbit hole for me personally. It was kind of one of the first styles that my wine mentor really helped me get into. For anybody in the Madison area, the tasting room is doing a tasting on sparkling wine next Tuesday at 5 p.m, which will be really fun for me, because then I get to, you know, nerd out for like an hour and a half on sparkling wine. So like, anytime I get to go further down the hole is fun for me. But as a rule of thumb, that word Method Traditionnel or Champagne Method is, you should see that as like a big signpost of, hey, try me, because even if I'm not from Champagne, I'm going to be made properly.
Great. Thanks for the tip. We're talking with Reed Joseph, who's walking us through the wine list, helping better equip us to find the bottle that's best for us. And we are taking calls. We've got Ruth Ann in Madison, who is ready to talk with us about wine. Hey, Ruth Ann.
Hi. I was wondering what, I like really dry red wines, and I'm wondering if there are any organic ones that you recommend. And I have a second question about, sometimes a Cabernet, for example, or a Merlot, whatever, will sometimes leave a really awful taste in my mouth, and then other times it doesn't. And I'm wondering why that might be.
Thank you so much, Ruth Ann. We appreciate your call. What do you think, Reed?
As far as the awful taste in your mouth, my guess would be poorly developed tannins. And that's a lot of words that don't make sense to, like, maybe he doesn't know, but like, the thing about wine where it sits on your tongue, kind of like tea does, that's, you know, what they call tannins. It's one of the compounds that comes out of the skins when you're making red wine. And in the same way that, again, using coffee, an example, some dark French roast coffee is really bitter in a charcoal way, and some dark black coffee is very bitter in a pleasant way. Sometimes the red wine, especially when you give really heavy grapes like Cabernet Sauvignon, the way the tannins sit, it just lingers. It's like kind of like you took a bite of drywall. And, you know, sometimes when you have better developed tannins, that doesn't happen. One of the factors is age. As the wine ages in the bottle, it might, you know, it's going to develop a little bit more and those tannins will be softer. Maybe how the wine was stored, if it, you know, maybe got a little too hot or too cold, then some of the acidity might be coming out a little bit more. I guess I'm trying to think through, like, the last time I had a wine that I took a sip and I was just like, you know, had to wash my mouth out with soap afterwards. But as far as organic wines, there are a lot of great organic wineries, and they'll usually tell you on the bottle. The wine industry in general is moving more in the direction of organic, what they call biodynamic, you know, more sustainable farming and winemaking practices. And so when a wine is made organic, they'll let you know. We have a couple of organic wines on our list. But that's usually when somebody brings in the wine and it's organic, it's the first thing out of their mouth. And so, you know, pick up a couple of bottles, and if it's organic, it'll have a big sticker on the back letting you know.
Excellent. Probably worth a try if that's the kind of wine that you're looking for. Also, again, if you see an organic wine on a list that you could buy by the glass, try it out that way first.
Mm-hmm. That's one of my favorite ways to find wine is, you know, I'll try a glass of it and then go and, you know, buy that bottle somewhere I think I can find it. Mm-hmm. A little bit of inside baseball on this is most restaurants price their wine where the price of the glass is what you pay for the bottle wholesale. And they do that so that if somebody buys one glass and then maybe they don't serve that wine for the next couple of days, they can pour the bottle of wine out and at least they recoup their cost. So if you're at a restaurant and you try your wine and it's $14 a glass and it's excellent, you can probably find that wine somewhere for $15-16 a bottle.
Excellent. These are perfect tips, Reed. I feel like I am more equipped to walk into the weekend now. I want to say thank you so much for being with us today.
Thank you so much for having me on.
Reed Joseph is the beverage director at the Tasting Room of Monona. He was with us on this Food Friday to teach us about wine, make us a little more informed consumers of our favorite reds and whites. And again, we've got this posted on the Ideas Network Facebook page. So if you'd like to contribute and continue the conversation, that's where you can go. This is Central Time. A moment of reverence, please, for August 4th. It is, in fact, International Beer Day. All around the globe, beer enthusiasts are celebrating their beverage of choice, shouting it from the rooftops that their rightful day has finally arrived, or so I like to imagine. But don't tell anyone this. I'm not really a beer person. I try. I do. And I have found beer that I do like. It's just not my go-to drink of choice. And do know that I recognize the risk I share taking this information to you as a Wisconsin resident, but I trust you'll keep it confidential. Still, I have a great difficulty resisting a theme, so today, sure. When my work is done, I commit to you that I will try to enjoy a cold beer. But I'm going to drink it while wearing my t-shirt that says, if you're going to be salty, bring the tequila. I'm Keely Boltina, in for Rob Barrett. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network.